Before we get started with our one case set for oral argument, I wanted to explain, as you know, of course, Justice Basil is a member of this panel, but he had a last-minute issue come up, so he will remain on the panel. He'll, of course, listen to the oral arguments afterwards, but he will not physically be here. So,
I asked for permission to go sit in his seat just to confuse y'all, but it was not granted.
Correct. So, as you know, to my right is Justice Wade Birdwell. I'm Elizabeth Kerr, and I understand counsel have all checked in, and we're ready to go. So I'll ask the clerk to call the case, please.
May it please the court. The court will now call Marilyn D. Garner, Chapter 7 trustee, versus Jack in the Box. Ms. Karen Frisella will argue for appellant, and Mr. Brett Kutnick will argue for appellee.
Ms. Priscilla.
May it please the court. My name is Karen Priscilla, and I'm here today with Chris Knight on behalf of the appellant, Trustee Marilyn Garner. In 9 findings favorable to J&D, the jury found that J&D had done what it had to do to sell its remaining 31 franchise Jack in the Box stores, in which J&D had paid $15 million for 37 stores in 2011, but was forced to surrender them for nothing in 2017, despite multiple proposals to offer to buy for $10 to $13 million. And the jury found that Jack in the Box acted in bad faith and violated the California Unfair Trade Practices Act during that process, which caused J&D to suffer an $8 million loss in fair market value.
So let me just interrupt you for a second. Where do you think that $8 million figure came from, since there was no expert testimony presented on fair market value?
Well, there was a range of different offers. There was
But none of them was as low as 8, was it?
Ibrahim's was 10.61. Dominguez was 10.5. And
But you're not arguing that as a matter of law, the jury should have awarded more?
No,
we're
not making
value.
That argument. Ibrahim did come back at one point much later in the game, when Dominguez and Hidalgo were about to be denied, and offered $6 to $7 million. So there would be a basis for the jury to kind of split in between, but we're not arguing that it's exactly 8. It has had a range of evidence. But the trial court disregarded every one of those findings. But the Supreme Court of Texas told us recently in Rudolph that disregarding a jury's verdict is an unusually serious act that imperils a constitutional value of immense importance, the authority of a jury, and should be done only for good, sound, cogent reasons. The trial court here gave none. So I'd like to spend my time today on the flip side of the argument, obviously, one being that we're entitled to the judgment, and the other that they're not entitled to a take-nothing judgment. As to the first point, as you know, you have to reconcile the findings as reasonably possible in light of the pleadings, the evidence, the manner of submission, and the other findings considered as a whole. If done so here, it's easy to give effect to the jury's answer and not alter the findings as Jack in the Box wants to do. So I prepared a chart to try to make some sense of how the jury was thinking, and it's chart A in your oral argument exhibits. And it demonstrates the charge as a whole shows the jury's thinking as to these 9 favorable findings. If you look first at the set of bad faith findings on breach of the implied covenant of good faith, harm, and damages, there's a few important points to note. So the measure of damage in 13 is the fair market value. And that measure of damage is a during the period of November 2016 to May 2017, which was the period that Jack in the Box, that J&D was trying to sell the Jack in Box stores. That's consistent with question one, where it says J&D has done all that's required to do to sell the restaurants. It's also consistent with question 10, that J&D was excused from having to do all that he had to do. And it's consistent with question 13, resting on his efforts to sell the restaurants. And question 10 is consistent with question one, that he had done all he had to do that was required to sell the restaurants.
Isn't 10 a little bit more expansive than one, though? Because one is limited to efforts with regard to
it is, but,
the sale.
But that's what I'm trying to do is synthesize them, because when you look at what the jury did, the question one was to sell the restaurants. The measure of damage was to sell the restaurants. And so to be consistent with a no answer later on, then you have to say they were saying he hadn't done everything, but he had done what he needed to do to sell the restaurants.
Okay, but under Castile, are we able to make those kind of references, those kind of inferences that you're asking us to make?
Well, the jury found he'd done all he had to do, so I guess.
Well, I understand. So that they substantially performed with regard to the sale of the stores, okay? That's one.
Right.
But then there would have been no reason, but then did they do all that they were required to do under the agreements, which is the entire scope of the agreements, and they find no.
Yeah, but then later they found that he hadn't done what they needed to do before termination or at termination. So you have to look at all of them to see what they're inquiring into in the questions. So that's kind of what I'm trying to make clear. So you have three different questions on the excuse.
Well, I guess my question really boils down to, since it is kind of a Castile question, how are we to be able to make sure that we understand what evidence was prompting the jury to answer each of these questions the way that they did?
Well, I think that's the standard in Bender. When you're reconciling the jury findings, you have to look at the charge as a whole and the pleadings and the evidence. And these are the categories of cases that they were claims they were looking at. They were looking at breach of the consent provision, breach of the faith and fair dealing, and breach of the termination provisions.
So what exactly was the jury taking into account in questions 9 and 10 and 11, because it wasn't tied to any particular, it was, you've got one question dealing with the consent sale, you've got another one later on dealing with termination, and so what were 9, 10, and 11 really all about?
Well, that's why I'm looking at the measure of damage for fair market value, the time period that they're looking at, because that is the dates that they were trying to sell the restaurants.
So so there was a time between the beginning of the sale and when the contracts were actually terminated by Jack in the Box.
Right. Okay. Yeah, well, one came before the termination and one came after.
Right.
And so the last date is the surrender agreement date.
What about Jack in the Box's arguments that once the contracts had been terminated, the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing kind of falls by the wayside?
Well, there's two problems with that. One is that the contract had a provision on continuing obligations, and Jack in the Box continue to exercise its rights under paragraph 16, so they were still obligated to do that in good faith under the law, and that's Powerhouse Motorsports, but also it's just contract construction as well.
I guess I haven't had enough sleep, but I'm having a hard time wrapping my mind around the jury's conclusion that, or its finding, that Jack in the Box did not unreasonably withhold its consent to sell to either the pre-termination or the post-termination group. So how does that all blend into what's going on with 9 through 13?
Well, 9 through 13 wasn't limited by its terms to termination and consent. So it's broader than that. It's just unfairly interfering with the benefits of the agreement. And if you look at the law, California, which is what is applied here, The cases that look at that and say, is it more than an express contract? They're looking for something unfair, outside, above and beyond, something more than just the express breach provisions. Otherwise, they would probably be duplicative.
Right, right.
So what was it that wasn't, didn't have anything to do with the withholding of consent?
Well, basically
that constituted a breach of the duty of good faith and fair dealing, or termination for that matter.
Right. Well, the jury heard evidence about a scheme to oust Morrissey as an operator and owner of J&D so it could retake J&D's restaurants and repackage them to corporate stores, sell them to preferred franchisees, and make a profit for itself, and give the relief on rent, royalty, and closures that it didn't give to J&D. And
why would that not be interrelated to the consent, withholding consent, and termination? Since to effectuate that, you would still need to terminate so they could take over the stores. And at the same time, since the sales were being attempted, you would have to withhold consent as well.
But
that's where I think I'm having
difficulty
is where much of this is all interrelated, and how are we to determine what is separate enough that there's not an irreconcilable conflict between the jury's findings?
There's a case that you have at tab H in your exhibits, and it tells you that there can be an express breach and still be a breach of the applied covenant of good faith and fair dealing. So that's what I was talking about. You look at what else was going on, what other unfair conduct was going on. And here you have, I have a litany of it, and that timeline that I put in your exhibits shows you the different things that were going on while they were withholding consent and planning to terminate without telling him. So for example, they failed to disclose the plans to terminate, and they offered to assist him in selling the businesses. But behind the scenes, they were repackaging the Jack in the Box stores of J&D with their own. They were also never going to approve Hidalgo as a buyer, but they didn't tell him that. Instead, they worked with him all along and then denied him even after the agreements. So I have a lot of that in the brief.
So you're making a distinction between nonfeasance and malfeasance. Withholding consent unreasonably would not necessarily include actively undercutting the ability of your client to actually sell the stores.
Well, and they promised three different times that they would assist with the sale, but they did quite the opposite. They wouldn't give reasons for the denial. They were packaging these stores without telling him. They knew they were going to terminate, but they didn't tell him that either. They made him feel like they were really looking at the Hidalgo Dominguez deal, but they weren't. They were planning to close. They wouldn't give him the relief that they were giving other franchisees, and that's how they enticed them to put those J&D stores in with the corporate stores from which Jack in the Box would profit. So it had a profit motive. And unfair.
Basically, had they been withholding their consent and then going around to each one of these stores and are doing acts of arson at the same time, necessarily the acts of arson would not necessarily be part of withholding consent, but it could be a part of a general decision on their part to make it impossible to sell the stores.
Right. And what this case that I put in your exhibits says is it's not unusual for the same facts and the same relief to be involved in a breach of implied duty case. And so you can have a breach of express provision and a breach of the bad faith provision. But you might not have a breach, and you still have a breach of bad faith. So they're not the same. You have to have that something more. One of their other arguments, I'll just skip to this one, is question 9 on substantial performance is dispositive of question 10 on excuse, but those are inquiring into two different things, and it rests on a theory that substantial performance is the only element that would require or be satisfied for the duty of good faith and fair dealing, and that's not accurate. This is just a breach of contract. It's an implied covenant, but it's still just a breach of contract, and the elements there are performance or excuse. And here, since the question 10's answer was yes, it's question 10 that trumps question 9, not the other way around. Makes sense.
Well, and that seems to be, I printed off the California, I guess, their version of the pattern jury charge, mm-hmm. Their VF 304, which looks like it was, you know, did the plaintiff do everything, but if not, was it excused? And right. You're saying that that's what we've got.
And I
here,
put that so as Exhibit Y to the reply brief as well. And then he gets to question 14 and says, well, the word before in there means that it's limits the duty to only after. And I can go through a little bit on rebuttal why that doesn't work. It also doesn't work that the word agreements is in the bad faith question for many reasons, one of which is that's not right. But also, even if it did mean that, it wouldn't work. Those two agreements are interrelated, and even a breach of the lease agreement or not, it would still be a duty facing it fairly dealing breach. And my time's about up, so.
Oh, I'm sorry you didn't get the yellow light.
Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. The party's relationship in this case was governed by contracts. The jury correctly found that J&D did not substantially perform those contracts and that neither Jack in the Box nor Jack in the Box Eastern Division breached the franchise or lease agreements. Ms. Garner's efforts to attach different claims to her contract claims are unavailing. She takes a shotgun approach on appeal by raising countless issues and attacking virtually every aspect of the trial court proceedings. I want to spend my time this afternoon focusing on her claim for breach of the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing, with a particular emphasis on the liability issue. Unless the court has any questions, I'll rely on the briefing for the other claims and issues. There are multiple paths for this court to affirm the take-nothing judgment on the implied covenant claim. The easiest path does not require this court to even address the substantive merits, because Ms. Garner failed to challenge all the independent grounds upon which the J&OV might rest. On pages 29 and 32 of Jack in the Box's brief, we cite several cases, including this court's opinion in Lesher, holding that an appellate court must affirm a judgment without addressing the merits when, as here, an appellant fails to adequately challenge an independent ground for J&OV that the appellee raised in the trial court.
So it's essentially the summary judgment rule at the J&OV level.
Absolutely. And Your Honor, in this case, we raised 23 separate grounds for disregarding the jury's findings to questions 10 through 13 and rendering J&OV. The trial court granted that motion and signed a take-nothing judgment without specifying its reason. But on appeal, Ms. Garner doesn't challenge each of those independent grounds. On pages 30 to 31 of Jack in the Box brief, we give examples of 8 separate grounds that Garner does not attack or adequately address in her brief. If the court agrees that any one of those grounds was not adequately challenged, the judgment on the implied covenant claim must be affirmed.
Did your 23 grounds cover all of the jury findings, or was it serial in nature? In other words, grounds 1 through 5 dealt with the jury finding to question number 10.
The 23 grounds was just limited to questions 10 through 13 on the implied covenant.
Globally, all 23 applied globally to all.
No, Your Honor, we had separate grounds to ignore the CUPA findings. We didn't need those to ignore the disregard the CUPA liability findings. We didn't need them to get the take nothing judgment because we had a zero damage finding, but we had independent grounds just related to that claim. And then even some of the other claims we had independent grounds on. If the court reaches the merits, the result is the same.
Just to clarify, you're sure. Not saying that if we find one of the 23 wasn't challenged, that we've got to affirm on every basis, because that one may not deal with each and every finding that you were trying to get the court to disavow.
On the implied covenant claim, if I'm understanding, that's correct.
Okay. All right.
So if the court reaches the merits, the result's the same. Ms. Garner's purported entitlement to judgment on the implied covenant claim hangs on three frayed and slender threads: the jury's excuse finding in question 10, the jury's breach finding in question 11, and the jury's damages finding in question 13. There are multiple reasons why the trial court correctly disregarded each of those findings, but for appellate purposes, the take-nothing judgment must be affirmed if any one of those three findings cannot stand. In other words, you only have to agree with Jack in the Box on one single argument with respect to one of those three jury findings, and the entire implied covenant claim falls. Conversely, to reverse and render judgment in Garner's favor on that claim, the evidence and the law must support all three of those findings, and I effectively have to shoot 0 for 23 from the free throw line. On this record, there's no legal or factual basis to uphold any of those jury findings in questions 10, 11, and 13, much less all of them. I want to begin and focus on the liability or breach finding in question 11. There are two independent paths for deciding this issue. First, as a matter of law, Garner's implied covenant claim is invalid and superfluous. Second, the evidence is legally insufficient to support the jury's breach finding under the question as submitted. The starting point for the matter of law issue is the California Supreme Court's opinions in Karma Developers and Goose, which are discussed at on page 33 of Jack in the Box's brief. In Karma Developers, the California Supreme Court recognized that the implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing may not be read to prohibit a party from doing that which is expressly permitted by an agreement. And what the court said is that when conduct is expressly permitted by an agreement, such conduct is, quote, clearly within the party's reasonable expectations and can never violate an implied covenant of good faith and fair dealing.
What was the best evidence that the plaintiff presented at trial for what Ms. Priscilla was talking about in terms of the hidden agenda that she says Jack in the Box had, and stringing Mr. Morrissey along and not revealing that it intended to suck up all these stores and then repackage them and sell them for more franchise fees and more money?
Well, I don't think there is any good evidence to support that. And the more fundamental problem is it's inconsistent with their pleadings. If you look at, and this is in the Appley's oral argument exhibits, I think at tab 3.
Did you get the Appley's?
I don't know that I got Appley's.
We got appellants oral argument
filed it
handouts
this afternoon before. I can give you my copy if you want.
No, don't worry about it.
Well,
too many trees have already died.
I understand, Your Honor. What the court will see, if you look at plaintiff's petition, this is their live petition before at the time of trial. And in count one, and this is in paragraph 74 to 91, she alleges a claim for breach of the franchise agreement. And she complains about two things: that Jack in the Box breached section 16 of the franchise agreements by unreasonably withholding consent to two proposed sales, and two, that Jack in the Box improperly terminated the franchise agreements. And then you go to count two, which is the implied covenant claim. And this is what she alleges in paragraph 95. Jack in the Box breached the franchise agreements for the reason stated above in count one, which is a breach of contract. To the extent that Jack in the Box's actions or inactions are found not to constitute an express breach of the franchise agreements, they are at a minimum a breach of the implied covenant of fair, good faith and fair dealing.
Well, did the trial court's grant of a trial amendment, were those allegations fleshed out farther?
The trial court did grant a trial amendment over our objection, uncontroverted evidence of unfair surprise and prejudice, and a claim that was prejudicial on its face, to add one additional fact about the transaction with Umar Ibrahim. Not all this other stuff that they're alleging now. That stuff is nowhere in the petition under the implied covenant claim. It's just revisionist history. And again, you look at paragraph 96 of their petition. This is what they say, quote, Jack in the Box breached the implied covenant by unreasonably withholding consent to the proposed sales to the Durrett Group and the Hidalgo Group. Of course, as we just discussed, those are the same breaches Garner alleged in her breach of contract claim. And if you look back, and if I could turn back to the law, because the California Supreme Court has said, and this is in the Guz case, that to the extent an implied covenant claim seeks to impose limits on a party's contractual rights beyond those to which the parties actually agreed, the claim is invalid. And to the extent the implied covenant claim seeks to invoke terms to which the parties did agree, it's superfluous. And I would direct the court to the Caro and Soil Retention Products cases, which are cited on page 34 of Jack in the Box's brief, because those California courts concluded that if a plaintiff's allegations do not go beyond the statement of a mere contract breach and rely on the same alleged acts, simply seek the same damages already claimed in a companion contract cause of action, they may be disregarded as superfluous as no additional claim is actually stated. And that's what we have here. And I think the real proof is if you look at the plaintiff's proposed jury charge after the close of the evidence. This is in our oral argument exhibits at tab 4. And I want to emphasize, this was filed 2 days after the close of the evidence, when they had time to reflect on how does the evidence, how do we view our evidence on the implied covenant claim, and how to best frame the theory for the jury. And what the court will see is that the implied covenant claim that they proposed ran afoul of all these legal principles, because all they did was proposing questions 1A, 2A, and 4A, breach of contract questions on the withholding of consent of the proposed sales to the two groups and the termination of the agreements. Consistent with her petition, she then requested almost identical liability questions in questions 1B, 2B, and 4B on her implied covenant claim. And then in questions 1C, 2C, and 4C, Garner wanted the jury to award her the same damages based on an affirmative finding to either the breach of contract or the implied covenant claim. 2 days later, during the charge conference, Garner acknowledged that her implied covenant claim was, quote, solely or substantially predicated on the failure to approve buyers. That's at 27 RR 60 to 61. Her petition, her proposed charge, and her repeated assertions simply prove my point, that the implied covenant claim relied on the same alleged acts and sought the same damages claimed in her companion breach of contract claims. In addition, the conduct about which she complains was specifically authorized by the agreements and was therefore within the reasonable expectation of the parties as a matter of law. Paragraph 18 of the franchise agreements expressly granted Jack in the Box the right to terminate the franchise agreements for various reasons. Paragraph 16 authorized Jack in the Box to withhold consent to proposed sale under certain circumstances, and the jury rejected their breach of contract claims based on those same acts. Under these circumstances, the trial court correctly rendered a take-nothing judgment on the implied covenant claim because it's superfluous, invalid, and fails as a matter of law.
Did you make that objection at the charge conference, or did you wait until the JNOV motion to make that objection?
Which objection? That it's superfluous?
Did you make an objection that 9 and 10 and 9 and 10 and 11 should not have even been submitted because it was superfluous based upon the pleadings as they stood?
Yes, Your Honor. We made an objection that it was invalid and superfluous both in the charge conference. I think we also did it in directed verdict motions, and we even had a summary judgment.
And obviously, Judge Taylor submitted it anyway, so I'm guessing he overruled those objections and then thought better of it at the JNOV hearing. Throughout
the trial, Judge Taylor expressed serious concerns, but like most trial judges, we had been through a four-week trial. He's going to let it go to the jury and then revisit the issues, and that's what happened in this case. I want to talk a little bit about kind of this revisionist history in trying to say, oh, there's some other things that are part of the implied covenant claim. There are kind of five fundamental problems with that. Number one, it's inconsistent with the petition. She didn't plead an implied covenant claim based on these other alleged acts.
Do you acknowledge the nonfeasance, malfeasance distinction that I'm making? I'm not saying that it was pled that way, but there's a difference between withholding consent and whether that was reasonable to do so, and then affirmatively doing something in a malfeasance situation which would justify withholding consent, such as committing arson or something of that nature. I know that didn't happen here, but I'm using that as an example of the distinction between simply withholding consent as opposed to manufacturing improperly the basis for withholding consent.
I'd have to give that a lot of thought. I could see a circumstance where possibly that could work. I mean, if, for example, in this case, if instead of withholding consent, we didn't go one way or the other. We wouldn't consent, and we wouldn't reject the buyers, nor would we consent to the buyers, and we just kind of left them in limbo. Maybe that would be a situation where you could have some bad faith, but not under the facts of this.
But even there, that you're still dealing there with a breach because there was no action one way or the other. The duty to reasonably consent is an affirmative duty based upon reasonableness, and if you don't do anything, then you're not complying with the duty one way or the other. So that still doesn't go to where I'm going.
Yeah, I generally agree. I guess the only argument I'd say is the contract didn't have a time period for when you had to do it, and I could envision some scenario where you just wait so long that might be bad faith, but not a breach. But generally, I agree. The second problem with this revisionist history, it's at odds with the proposed jury charge, which we discussed. Many of the other acts that they're now complaining about are also expressly allowed by the agreement. A lot of the conduct occurred after the termination of the agreements, and I think, Justice Kerr, you're right. There is no implied duty of good faith and fair dealing after the contracts are terminated.
Well, of course, but J&D was continuing to operate for some period of time after termination.
They were, Your Honor, but let me just make two points about that. Number one, the parties were discussing a temporary license agreement. Jack in the Box had a duty to mitigate its damages. If you recall, Jack in the Box was the one who had to sue J&D to get them out of the premises. So we had a duty to mitigate, and if they could find a buyer, we were happy. We wanted that to happen because we didn't want to take over the stores. The second thing is the leases themselves have a provision for holdover rent. And so the mere fact that they were still in the stores doesn't mean we are still operating under this agreement, which was terminated by letter on January 31, 2017. We might have been operating under this temporary license. It wasn't signed, but we're kind of going back and forth. And it was only going to be a 60-day license, but it wasn't under the franchise agreement.
And what sort of duties of good faith and fair dealing would arise under that arrangement?
Well, in this case, it doesn't really matter because the jury question isn't about that agreement. And we don't know that agreement was never signed. And if it would only have duties if it was arose under California law, and because they never really had a meeting of the minds on it, it just doesn't matter. The fifth problem I want to mention about this kind of revisionist history is there's no causal nexus between these miscellaneous alleged acts and the fair market value damages she saw in question 13. And let me give you kind of an example. One of the things they complain about is that Jack in the Box put a store in the Fort Hood Army Base, and it supposedly took away some of their business for their stores in the area. Now, putting aside the fact that paragraph 1 of the franchise agreements specifically authorized Jack in the Box to do that, there's no connection between that alleged bad faith breach and the fair market value of the restaurants. At best, that might give them some right to recover lost profits from the affected stores. It doesn't give them the right to say, hey, you need to pay me the fair market value of 31 stores that span across all of Central and East Texas. Let me turn real briefly to another independent reason why the trial court correctly disregarded the jury's implied covenant liability finding. The evidence is legally insufficient to support the finding in question 11 that JIB breached its implied duty of good faith and fair dealing by unfairly interfering with J&D's rights to receive the benefit of the agreement. And I emphasize the word agreements because it's critical here. Under Texas law, The sufficiency of the evidence must be measured by the jury charge when, as here, Garner lodged no objection to the question. At Garner's request, question or definition number one of the charge defined agreements to mean collectively the franchise agreements and the lease agreements. Thus, to satisfy her burden, she had to show that Jack in the Box breached its implied duty with respect to both the franchise agreements and the lease agreements. She didn't meet that burden, and she can't meet that burden. There's at least three straightforward reasons why. First, Jack in the Box is not a party to the lease agreements. The lease agreements were between the tenant and Jack in the Box Eastern Division. Thus, Jack in the Box did not owe, and it cannot breach an implied duty under that agreement as a matter of law.
Well, so, but you don't think that reading 9 through 13 together, I mean, I understand in question 11 it says the agreements, which was defined as both, but when you put it in context, it seems like we're talking about the franchise agreements.
Your Honor, I don't think you can put it in context. I mean, I understand that most of their claims focused on the franchise agreements, but if you look at Oscar Burgovy Pekka and its progeny, you have to go by the jury charge.
So there was a single franchise agreement for every store that was involved?
There are 31 separate franchise agreements for each of the stores and 31 separate lease agreements.
Then why is this plural agreements not referring to the 31 franchise agreements?
Because
and
in the charge it's
lease agreements.
In the charge itself and the definitions. And this was at their request. Okay. The definition that the judge gave was it applies to both of them. And there's even an instruction, you got to use the definition I give. Real quickly, the two other reasons, unlike the franchise agreements, the lease agreements are governed by Texas law. There is no implied duty under Texas law, so you can't breach some non-existent duty. And third, there's no evidence that we did anything to interfere with the lease agreements. So their only complaint had to do with terminating, and the jury found no termination, no breach. Unless there are any questions, that concludes my argument.
Thank you very much, Mr. Kutnick. Before you get started, let me ask sort of a follow-up on the subject we just concluded with about this agreements, the global agreements phrasing in question 11.
Well, I think I mentioned this in opening, but you're right. The set of questions goes to agreements when you look at the excuse question, the instructions in those, and the damage question. But more than that, even if he were right, that agreements means lease and franchise agreements, question 11 didn't require the jury to find that both were breached. It defines it to say that every contract has a duty. So even if that's wrong.
But not in Texas, though.
Yeah, but that's what the charge says. So that's what you review it by.
And was there a discussion at the charge conference from either side about the use of that word agreements in question 11?
I can look. I don't remember because that wasn't an issue here. So I, charge conference was like 2 days. So, but for him to act like these are completely independent is really interesting because they're interlocked franchise agreements and lease agreements. It contemplates Jack in the Box standard lease form with rent calculated in gross sales and payable to Jack in the Box, giving Jack in the Box the right regarding leased premises, approval leases, and the rent relief that they wanted would come through the lease agreements. To terminate the franchise agreements, Jack in the Box relied on the alleged faults raised in the premises and business facilities governed by the leases. And so in terminating the franchise and lease agreements, Jack in the Box, for its own profit, interfered with JD's rights to receive the benefits of both the franchise and the lease agreements.
Was there any ground that was solely based upon a non-performance under the franchise agreement, or did I just understand you to say that all of the non-performance that was alleged against J&D was based upon non-performance under the lease agreements?
Many of them, I'd have to get the...
Yeah, I think question 17 dealt specifically with the lease agreements, but otherwise, I think it was franchise agreements.
Right. Okay. Going back to Mr. Kutnick's argument, it's interesting that he says that we didn't respond. I think that he means that he doesn't agree with our response. In our response at page, our reply brief at page 31 to 32, we explain where we respond to each one. And your question was, were they all independent? The answer to that's no, and I think his own little boxes show that, where he puts five different ones on the lease agreement in different points. And even he doesn't really know how many he raised, because he said that he raised at least 23 independent grounds. So there's a bunch of them that are related, and we did answer them all, and I've got that at page 31 and 32 of the brief. Karma does say what he said, but it also says you don't have to have an express breach to have a duty of good faith and fair dealing claim.
Well, what about his point on the way it was pleaded?
Well, he's got the Fourth Amendment in here, where the Fifth Amendment is the last live pleading. But here's paragraph 96.
You're talking about the trial amendment, or?
This is the fourth.
The fourth, okay. Mm-hmm.
J&B's delay in this regard, especially when combined with Jack in the Box wrongful termination of the franchise agreements and retaking control of the franchise to resell them for its own benefit, thereby profiting by tens of millions of dollars, is a quintessential breach of the implied duty of good faith and fair dealing.
So you think that's broad enough to overcome what was apparently in paragraph, what was it, the beginning of he alluded to paragraph 74, 90 through 91. I don't have the pleading right here to hand, but did it say, you know, based on the same grounds that we've raised for breach of contract, this is, maybe I'm confused.
Well, the point is, it's not just the consent and termination. It expressly says that it's more than that. It's this whole retaking scheme. And under Texas fair notice pleading, that's under the duty of good faith and fair dealing claim. In our reply brief, our appellant's brief, we have a long list, and I plan today to go through another long list of different things. But I can put those into a post-submission brief, because the revisionist history is kind of interesting, because this has been in the case since summary judgment, and this was a four-week trial. So to say that it's something new and revisionist is really interesting. I can answer agreements on a little more if you want in the post-submission brief as well. But I'd like to conclude by saying that this was a four-week trial with like 18 witnesses, hundreds of exhibits, and the jury worked really hard to get where it was going to go, and we'd like to get some credit that it deserves. We'd ask the court to reverse.
Thank you very much. With that, your case is submitted, and Justice Birdwell, I'm fine with giving leave for post-submission briefs. I think that might be useful. We also welcome.
As long as it's not old forest trees.
yes. And if we would also encourage you to think about making another run at settling this case, because I'm not sure either side's going to be happy with what we end up doing. But anyway, thank you very much.
Thank you.
All rise. The Honorable Court of Appeals for the Second District of Texas now stands adjourned.